All right, it's good to see everyone this morning. We don't need a whole lot of an introduction because Clint's been with us many times and the last two Sundays. And today, unfortunately, is his final in this series of the Psalms for Lent. Clint McCann.
Thank you. I'll appreciate that. Welcome, everyone. Thanks again for the opportunity to be here today and for the season again. Appreciate that. As we've noted past couple of Sundays, there are connections between your congregation and Eden Seminary, and we know about that and appreciate that kind of partnership and look forward to continued working together in a variety of ways. Alan left a list up here of Lenten virtues. We'll see if we may want to add to that. I'm not going to let you take anything away from it, but maybe not add, just reinforce some of those. But at any rate, our task for today, and we may not get completely through it, the third, fourth, and sixth Sundays of Lent. I'm actually going to suggest we start with the sixth and sort of move backward, but because I have two musical versions of Psalm 31. Some of you appreciate the musical versions, and I think they're important too. I've got one from the Tizé community in France and one from the Iona community in Scotland. Two places that are precious to me. We spent a week in the summer of 2011. My wife Sarah had one of those Lilly pastoral grants where they give lots of money to practicing pastors. Pastors of congregations who have sabbaticals. So she had a sabbatical and they gave her $50,000. So we spent 7 weeks in Europe and it wasn't work. You were just supposed to have fun, they said. So we had fun. The work component was for my wife to study the musical traditions of Iona and Tizé. So we spent a week at each of those communities. I'm going to start with, if the thing works here, I'm always suspicious of the thing. This is a CD from the Iona community. John Bell is their one of their major musicians and poets and lyricists and so on. This is called Psalms of Patience, Protest, and Praise. Patience being assurance psalms, protest being the lament psalms, praise being the hymns or the songs of praise. This is their version of Psalm 31 that they've entitled, In You, O God, I Found Refuge. If you look at Psalm 31, as we will in a moment, you'll see that one of the key words, beginning in verses 1 and 2, and then later at least one more time, is the word refuge. It's also a very important word in the book of Psalms, but we'll talk about that maybe in a minute too. Oops.
In you, O Lord, I find refuge. Let me never more be put to shame. In you, O Lord, I find refuge. Let me never more be put to shame. By your saving power, deliver me. Bend down your ear and hear.
That's a responsorial psalm, I call those, where the composer picks a verse, in this case the first verse, and lets it be sort of thematic, and that wasn't the whole psalm, obviously, it's the first five or six verses, with the refrain recurring, so that it allows the composer to emphasize a key word or concept. Not always, it doesn't have to be the first verse. But anyway, refuge in this case, although it did get to verse 5, which is probably the most famous verse in the psalm, right? Does that sound familiar? Into your hands I commit my spirit. We saw with Psalm 22 how the gospel writers picked up, or Jesus himself, or both, picked up lines from the Psalter. Psalm 22, of course, my God, why have you forsaken me? To express the anguish and agony of the cross. Luke, the Gospel of Luke, or at least Jesus's, or the recording of Jesus' words in the Gospel of Luke, does not include, my God, why have you forsaken me? Instead, Luke has Jesus utter from the cross a line from Psalm 31, into your hands I commend my spirit, or I commit my spirit. So that's probably the most famous line. And this next version that represents the Tezay style is entitled, it's that verse essentially, over and over again, in manos tuas pater. I think that's Latin. Do we know Latin? Some of you know Latin. I know manos and mano in Spanish is hands, and hands. So at any rate, that's the bells of Tezay that call us to worship. I'll advance it to Psalm 31 in a moment here after you hear the bells. And this will just repeat many times for several, 3 or 4 minutes. In manos tuas pater, into your hands, Father.
Thank you.
Though, as you heard, it was just one line for 4 minutes. In manos tuas, Pater, into your hands, Father. Commendo spiritu meum. Commendo in Spanish, that would be a first person singular. So I think that's the case in Latin too. I, into your hands, I commit my spirit. But when we went to today, I thought it would be boring because I'm an energetic type person and I don't just like to sit there quietly. And every today service, or the main service in the middle of the day at least, there's today is silence, singing, chanting like that, and prayer, scripture, in a variety of languages usually. And I thought that would be boring because I like to get up and walk around and run around and all kinds of stuff. But I found it actually, to my surprise, quite moving. And probably what people like me need are more times just to sit there and listen, you see. So I, over the years, have treasured the Tezay chant tradition. Where, in fact, I usually have in my car a couple of Tezay CDs to listen to as I drive. They don't put me to sleep or anything. Is that my thing? Or is that something else? They don't relax me enough to put me to sleep, but they do sort of slow you down, and there's a kind of effect, a chant, like almost a mantra type effect of just listening. So anyway, Psalm 31, you have it in front of you. We've heard a couple of versions. One of the key words is refuge, notice. In you, O Lord, I seek refuge. Be a rock of refuge for me. Verse 2, verse 4, take me out of the net that is hidden from me, for you are my refuge. Where's another one, I think, verse 19. Oh, how abundant is your goodness that you have laid up for those who honor you or fear you and accomplish for those who take refuge. So at least three or four times, I think one of those is actually a different Hebrew word than the main Hebrew word for refuge. But again, illustrative of what we've seen with the other Psalms, that the psalmist will repeat quite intentionally a word that they want us to notice, a key word. It happens to be a key concept in the book of Psalms as well. As early as Psalm 2, the last line of Psalm 2 is happy, blessed, or happy are all who take refuge in Him, refuge in God. And that becomes a kind of key word, not just for Psalm 31, but for the whole Psalter, really. There's a scholar at Pittsburgh Seminary who did a dissertation on the concept of refuge in the Psalter, arguing that it was sort of built in and placed periodically at key points. What that's the correlate of, the reason the psalmist always need refuge or seek refuge is because they're, as we've seen, consistently opposed. Enemies, foes, seekers, and so on. And you get that here in Psalm 31. It is a lament, unlike Psalm 22. It's a lament. And the laments are the most frequent type of psalm in the Psalter. And one of the characteristics of the laments is that the enemies, the foes, the wicked are always there. Not, it's not just the presence of the enemies, as I put it, it's the omnipresence of the enemies, which means that refuge becomes a necessity for the psalmist. Do we see indications of this in Psalm 31? Anything that stands out in that regard?
I was looking at verse 11. Scorn of my adversaries, a horror to my neighbors.
Yeah.
The object of dread to my acquaintances, that's pretty strong.
That is pretty strong. It's kind of piling it on. Scorn of my adversaries, which is bad enough, but a horror to my neighbors isn't very good either, you see. And then an object of dread to my acquaintances. That is as good instances of Hebrew parallelism there, where they sort of synonymously repeat. But usually when there's a parallelism like this, each one gets a little bit worse. In this case, they're all pretty bad, so I'm not sure one of them gets worse. But yeah, there's a good example of the opposition. Those who see me in the street flee from me. That leads into verse 13. Look, that's 11, and then 12 goes in the same direction. I've become like a broken vessel. The debilitating effect of this sort of persistent opposition. And then look at verse 13. For I hear the whispering of many. Terror all around. That has a particular kind of ring to it to me in our context. Maybe it's just the word terror. But with all the talk of terrorism and with the just the pervasive violence in our culture. I mean, I posted something on Facebook that I probably shouldn't have posted the other day. But I was just angry that every time I drop my daughter and son off at school, I tell them I love them, and I worry that I may never see them again alive. I mean, that's awful, you know, to have to live with that sort of persistent kind of anxiety and fearfulness and so on. Alan said y'all were having somebody come in to talk about anxiety, so maybe she can help us out there. But terror all around, so it may have a particular sort of currency. It also has a kind of currency elsewhere in Scripture. Does that? I'm not sure that's all that famous a verse, but there's one of the prophets in particular who was particularly opposed. They were all opposed, right? Amos was told to leave the country. They wanted to deport him because he had criticized the king. That has a kind of familiarity to it, too. As our place, you're not supposed to criticize. You know, the patriots are not supposed to criticize the government. So on. But the prophets did it all the time. And Jeremiah in particular. Jeremiah is sometimes known as the weeping prophet, right? There is in the book of Jeremiah a whole series of what in biblical scholarship have been called traditionally Jeremiah's confessions, but that's all too nice a word. They're really Jeremiah's complaints or laments, where Jeremiah complains about the very sort of thing that verse 11 that Jim highlighted was talking about. He complained that because he was being faithful and speaking the word of God, he was suffering. In other words, he wasn't suffering because he was bad. He was suffering because he was good and faithful. So he complained about the scorn of adversaries, and not just the scorn of adversaries. Part of his complaint was that he's alienated everybody, including his neighbors, friends, and family, you see. So it's not surprising that verse 13 of Psalm 31 gets sort of quoted in Jeremiah chapter 20, which is one of these complaints. That there are several in the book of Jeremiah. Chapter 20, verse 3, sort of gives the situation. The next morning when Pashur released Jeremiah from the stocks, Jeremiah had actually been, you know, detained, as it were, by one of the priests who wasn't too pleased with what he was saying, apparently. Jeremiah said to him, "The Lord has named you, has named you not Pashur, but terror all around." And then a little bit later in that chapter, chapter 20, verse 10, as Jeremiah's lament or complaint proceeds, he says essentially the same thing as the psalmist has said here, "For I hear many whispering," that is opposing him behind his back as well as publicly, "I hear many whispering terror all around." Terror is all around. "Denounce him, let us denounce him. All my close friends are watching for me to stumble. Perhaps he can be enticed and we can prevail against him and take revenge on him." Well, again, like the psalm, that's pretty bad. It's interesting that there is that sort of intertextual connection between the complaint or the lament of the psalmist in this case and the situation or life situation of the prophet Jeremiah at several points. It's not clear whether Jeremiah knew the psalm or whether the psalmist knew Jeremiah or whether they're all drawing on a traditional language. We just don't know. But the connection clearly is there. And by way of Psalm 31, verse 5, the connection or the trajectory runs not just through the psalm and its complaint, but also not just through Jeremiah and his complaint, but also the trajectory continues, making Psalm 31 and the whole sort of setup similar to what Jesus would encounter, if not exactly. Jesus suffered not because he was bad. Jesus suffered because he was being faithful. And it's the very faithfulness that encountered or evoked the opposition from priests, like in Jeremiah, and the authorities, both Jewish and Roman, in first century Jerusalem. So, not surprisingly, Luke, at least in his portrayal of Jesus, will have Jesus claim from the cross, into your hands I commend my spirit. In other words, I will totally entrust life to you, God. That is the faith or obedience that I am willing to display in this particular context. Notice verse 15 is similar in terms of the language, the hand in particular. As the psalmist continues, my times are in your hand, my future, I turn my future over to you. And by the way, I think with verse 5, into your hand I commit my spirit, a sort of good paraphrastic rendering of that was, I turn my life over to you. Actually, that would resonate, would it not, with Psalm 25 that we saw last week? Remember the first line of Psalm 25 that I argued a little bit with the NRSV translation? To you, O Lord, I lift my soul. In other words, I offer my life to you. So the Psalm 31, verse 5, as the psalmist uttered it, as Jeremiah had to do, and as Jesus did, totally entrusting life and times or future to God. That's, of course, what refuge is all about. My times are in your hand. Deliver me from the hand of my enemies and persecutors. There they are again. Let your face shine upon your servant. Save me in your steadfast love. We saw steadfast love. You remember steadfast love? In our first Sunday, we've erased the other Sundays, but the Ash Wednesday, well, the season, the psalm for Ash Wednesday is Psalm 51, which is a confession of sin appropriate for the season of Lent and so on. But before the psalmist dares to confess his or her sin, he or she celebrates God's steadfast love, God's mercy, and God's grace. So again, the psalmist takes his or her stand here, or the appeal is grounded in the very quintessential character of God, which is to be steadfastly loving, as we talked about. Actually, I think steadfast love, you could consider a key word in the psalm as well. If you track repetition, where else do we see it? Let's see. Verse 21. Blessed be the Lord, for he, God, has wondrously shown steadfast love to me. When I was beset as a city under siege. There again, the siege, the persistent and pervasive opposition. So you have it in verse 7, you have it in verse 21, and I think there's one more time, 16. Let your face, right after the verse of my hands, my times are in your hand, let your face shine upon your servant, save me and your son. So again, three times, 7, 16, 21. The key word, in this case, the word that fundamentally describes God's character, is repeated. And on that reality, the psalmist is able to entrust life and future to God, refuge. Anything else about Psalm 31 that would resonate with the season or with things we've talked about already or would reinforce some of our Lenten virtues here? Yeah.
I'm going to lift myself off the page a bit and wonder if that's any encouragement to the people in Syria at the moment.
Right.
You know, where somebody of power is sending bombs,
right,
fire.
What kind of, yeah.
What kind of encouragement?
What kind of encouragement is that? You know, a lot of, that's a question that I ask too, and I think that people in that context ask. You know, one of the frequent affirmations of Latin American theology, and I spent lots of time in Latin America, is God's preferential option for the poor, that is the suffering, and that God suffers with us. I think that's all right and faithful, But what their question many times, what does that do for me in the moment when bombs are dropping or bullets are raining down or whatever?
You can't sort of wallow in the comfort of one another's suffering.
Right, right. Well, that's the point.
There's got to be some action.
Yeah, yeah. Well,
change,
I think so, too.
Action to change.
Right. I think that's right, too. And I'm going to sort of, I think the Psalter gets us to that, or definitely invites us to that. I think we'll go from 31 to 19. So keep that issue in mind, because that, I think, is crucial. It doesn't do in terms of all we need to do to tell the suffering that what? God is with you. Don't worry about it. You see, because that's what the suffering have often been told.
Or we're suffering with you.
Or that we're suffering with you. Or that God's suffering with you. So what? Yeah. Right. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah.
Maybe related to that, as I read through this this morning, I was struck by it. It's all I, me, my. Mm-hmm. Until you get to verse 23.
Okay, yeah.
And the psalmist finally opens this up to
right.
All you, his saints.
Yeah, love the Lord, all you, his saints. And by the way, saints there, again, it's not, that's just a traditional translation. But that word saints is based on the same word that we're, or the same Hebrew root that we are translating steadfast love. So I think probably a better translation would be love the Lord, all you steadfastly loving ones, or faithful ones. Sometimes it's rendered as faithful ones. Yeah, I'm double checking myself here, but yeah. Hesed is the word for God's steadfast love. And this is another form of that root with a suffix on it. So you could do it either way. Love the Lord, all his steadfastly loving ones. That is, all the ones who try to emulate God's character and maybe God's purposes, will. So that might be at least an implicit call to action. Or love the Lord, all you steadfastly loved ones. But that again, the traditional NRSV, NIV, other major translations are going to render that saints, which may not be what we need to hear there. I don't know. But you're right. There's a turning point there to bring the whole community into it. Love the Lord, everybody. The Lord preserves the faithful, but abundantly repays the one who acts haughtily. Well, God does not do that. unilaterally. This is the issue, you see. So if God is going to repay the one who acts haughtily, how is that going to happen? You see, that's a crucial question. I think part of the value of these psalms for those who are suffering is at least to relocate God for them and thus energize them and those who stand in solidarity with them to resist. For so often, what have suffering people been told? Not just God is with you.
It's God's will.
It's God's will. That's right. It's God's will that you suffer. I'm thinking particularly of Latin American context, where the church told the poor that, you know, this is your lot in life. It's not just that you are suffering. You deserve to be suffering, and God has put you there, so you don't resist, you see. I'm going to take a group to El Salvador maybe this summer and maybe in January for our Eden trip next January, maybe both times depending on our numbers and so on. The people in El Salvador who told the poor that it's not God's will that you're suffering and God is with you, but we need to do something about it, what happened to them? They disappear. Many disappear. We don't know their names, but we know the names of some of the more prominent ones who were basically killed. The most prominent, of course, is Archbishop Oscar Romero, who in 1977 was appointed by the Vatican because they thought he wouldn't rock the boat. In other words, he had the respect of the oligarchs. The small minority that controlled the economic system and did their best to keep the poor, you see. And he, up to that time, he had been just sort of, you know, church stays out of politics and we'll bless the poor, but we won't do anything for them, you see. But in 1977, one of his priest, after he'd been appointed archbishop, one of his priests, Rutilio Grande, was assassinated as he drove between two of his little parishes in Paisnal and Aguilares. Just another car came up and just sprayed the car with bullets, killing him, an elderly gentleman that was riding with him, and a little boy that was in the back seat. You see, and that was Romero's conversion. So he started saying, it does no good simply to tell the poor that they're poor, and certainly not to tell them that it's God's will that they're poor. We're going to educate them differently and equip them for action. So basically, Rutilio Grande, who had already been doing what we would call community organizing, I suppose, these days in our context, he was killed, and then that converted Romero to the activist kind of stance that he took. And of course, 3 years later, he was assassinated too, on March 24th, 1980, in all likelihood with the permission of the United States State Department, which is this sort of sad, tragic kind of involvement of the United States in those sorts of things. But anyway, you're right, Alan. There's a major shift, as the psalm concludes, to draw in the whole congregation. And it concludes with a kind of, I don't know whether you call it a call to action or not, particularly given the word wait. Be strong and let your heart take courage, all you who wait for the Lord. That I don't really like the translation wait. We talked about, remember, that was one of the key words in Psalm 25. In verses 3 and 5, and then toward the end was wait. And I suggested another, and I think a better translation, is hope. And to me, hope is not a passive activity. Hope is a motivating, energizing activity. So what these psalms do, as well as the prophets and the gospels, it seems to me, is relocate God, not against the suffering, but with the suffering. And I'm hoping, at least, I trust that that will be an energizing force that will allow the suffering, the poor themselves, to resist oppression, and will allow or motivate those of us who are not necessarily economically poor to become what some Latin American theologians call evangelically poor. That is, use the resources that we do have on behalf of those who have those, who don't have those resources, those to stand with them over against, so that hope, waiting, patience, whatever, trust, faith, obedience, are not just passive virtues, but an activist stance. That's how I sort it out, at least, in the beginning to get it.
Maybe that should be added to
how I think it should. How do we phrase that?
Act.
Yeah. Act, you know, the Latin American theologians developed a kind of perspective or methodology, it's even sometimes called, and maybe you've seen it. It was, and that's the third piece in it. It was see, judge, which is not the best. I tend to put that evaluate. So you see what's going on in the world. You see, in Latin America, there were people, and here, there are people who don't want us to see what's going on. That is, they don't want us to acknowledge the violence. They don't want to acknowledge the hunger and poverty that's still present in the United States. And so on. So seeing, then evaluating that, is this God's will or not? Well, you know, no. And the third piece of that is act. Yeah, so do something, you see. So yeah, let's add that as a part of our list, that action, we might, other word, mission, whatever. I think I've told some of you, I'm still working on the Psalms project that I started a year and a half ago while I was on sabbatical, and I only wrote about half of it, and then I got busy again teaching. But I've gone back to it, a couple of chapters I wrote this summer, and then I wrote a chapter last week, and I'm in the middle of a chapter now. And my whole point in that thing is to reread the Psalms and comment on them from the point, or from this point, you see. That spirituality, which has often been sort of passive and meditative, like the Taizé stuff. That was kind of why I was suspicious of it. As I thought, well, what good is it going to do just to sit there and listen to him sing for 4 minutes? You know, is that going to do anybody any good?
You were in there for 2 hours.
Huh? Well, I was open. See, when I went to Taizé, I was open. I at least was open to that, or I wouldn't have gone. My wife had the money, so that was the first thing. And it was in France, southern France, in the Burgundy province. So they sold little cups of wine in paper cups for €1 every night at 6:15 or something. They'd open the snack bar and sell little paper cups of wine for 50 cents or €1. I guess that's more like $1.25 or something. But at any rate, but that's the question. What good will it do to sit around and listen to the songs if we don't act? But part of the way I fit that into my activist spirituality is what I'm calling this activist spirituality, or a commitment to justice, peace, and shalom, as God is committed to that. I think that we need both, that the meditative, listening, resting, thinking, time to evaluate, can fund or energize an activist spirituality is what I'm hoping. And that reading, the laments, is what I'm arguing, and this is Psalm 31's lament, Psalm 22's lament, are not just for the suffering to get it out, although that sometimes helps. It's just to say what we're experiencing. And again, suffering people have often been told, don't do that. We don't want to hear that. So victims have been told, whether it's domestic violence victims or whatever, have been told to, you know, keep it to yourself. Don't report it. Don't get it out. Which, of course, is totally unhealthy. And maybe illegal if you don't report certain things nowadays. But the whole point, it seems to me, in the protest element of these things is to name the injustice, you see, to get it out, publicly get it out, as well as get it out of yourself. And that's a step, that sort of protest, or as Walter Brueggemann puts it, saying where things are not right is the first step toward doing something about it. So that's just what I'm going to argue, that rehearing the laments as not just, I'm hurt, God help me, which is valuable, but we're hurting, God help us, and then help us to be involved in helping others, you see, so the activist component. What else? Anything else in 31. I get my number. I'm going to play, while you think about that, I'm going to play one more version that picks up this last verse, since we talked about waiting last time. Did somebody have their hand over here? Yeah.
I'm just wondering about verse 23 again.
Okay.
Love the Lord, all you his saints. If that's the word hasidim, does that have some echoes in that? Is this retrofitted or usable term in the intertestamental period for those who are under suffering anyway?
Right.
Which then kind of gives more continuity to why that's placed in Psalm 31.
Possibly. Yeah, I think you're right. Yeah, that's right. This is the word hasidim, which apparently became current to name a particular group of faithful ones.
They were under threat and suffering.
They were under threat, yeah. And probably the best instance of that in the Old Testament is the book of Daniel. You see, which reads like it's said in the Babylonian context, but almost certainly was in the 2nd century BCE when the Syrians were, or the Syrian component of the former Alexandrian Greek Empire, were persecuting, and opposing Jerusalem and desecrating the temple and all this kind of stuff. That's probably the impetus that organized the faithful ones, the Hasidim, to name themselves as such, and then they probably passed their tradition on to maybe the Pharisees. There may be some continuity between the suffering of the psalmist when and wherever it originated, and a group that later, in the face of persecution and suffering, clearly named themselves using this term, which may not have been an organizational term, or at some point, we are the faithful ones. Yeah. Yeah, so I think there is that kind of continuity. Mm-hmm. Yeah, good. I'm going to play one more version. It's not, it picks up, it's actually Richard Brooks Fort Colligan's version, of Psalm 27. But notice that Psalm 27 and Psalm 31 end much the same way. Be strong. Let your heart take courage, which I hear at least again implicitly as a call to action. So be strong and let your heart take courage, all you who wait for the Lord. This is Richard's version. That we've talked about Richard before. He's the contemporary psalmist. This is his one entitled Wait for the Lord. So it would apply to 25, 27, and 31 as well, I think. And it's one of my favorites of his.
Wait for God, be strong and let your heart take courage. Wait for God, be strong and let your heart take courage. Wait for God.
Traditional translation that's reflected here in 25, 27, and wait. And I've given the conversation, I want to be sure that's not heard simply passively. And I think as we turn to Psalm 19 in a moment, we can move in that direction. Anything else on 31 you wanted to highlight or ask about before we move to 19?
Shame is sort of a big concept in Hebrew thinking, isn't it?
Well, in that culture, probably.
Yeah.
To be
trying to not be put to shame.
Not be put to shame, yeah. Because again, think, and it's still sometimes in our culture, sickness or illness or suffering can be a source of shame. You don't want to talk about it. People don't want to come to church if they're hurting and be seen publicly crying or downcast or whatever. So yeah, but the shame may have been attached to suffering, in which case, again, to claim God with the sufferer rather than against the sufferer, I think, is a step in the right direction, at least. Mm-hmm. Anything else? Okay, look, 19. Remember last time I put that chiastic structure of Psalms 15 to 24, where 15 and 24 are the boundaries of this that invite entry into the temple. It would seem they're called entrance liturgies. And the middle component of a chiast, the chiastic structure, focuses attention to a central component. And the central component of that literary structure is Psalm 19. So it's given prominence. Is that something over here? Or is that,
no,
okay, I can't.
It's the sub-pump.
What is it?
The sub-pump.
Oh, okay. That's not the, okay. I thought it was my boombox acting up again. Okay, so 19 has some particular prominence, and it privileges, at a major turning point in it, it privileges the concept of Torah in verse 7. It's an interesting psalm. It's a beautiful psalm, but it's an interesting psalm because it starts with what? The heavens are telling the glory of God. The firmament proclaim God's handiwork and so on. Day to day pours forth speech. It starts with creation, it would seem. And then at verse 7, it shifts. Notice if you're reading the NRSV, there's a little white space left there to indicate some sort of break, it would seem, or at least transition. But a lot of time, or an earlier generation of scholars actually, saw that not just as a transition at verse 7, where the shift is to the law, NRSV, or the Torah, but actually a break there. So that older commentaries, when I first started studying the Book of Psalms for my dissertation and so on, there were lots of commentaries that listed comment on Psalm 19a, verses 1 to 6, and then comment on Psalm 19b, verses 7 to the rest of the psalm, 14 in English, as if they were two different psalms, you see. And that's, in fact, that's what the commentary said. In other words, we can't make sense to how verses 1 to 6 about creation and verses 7 to 14 about Torah have anything to do with each other. I think they have a lot to do with each other, and more recent commentators, myself and others, have moved to try to defend the unity of Psalm 19, that it's not two separate psalms. Here's how I do it, at least. You can think about that. The shift to verse 7, the law of the Lord is perfect. Again, I don't like the translation law. Torah means teaching or instruction or something as broad as the will of God. And perfect is also misleading. That word that means that word they're translating perfect means whole or comprehensive. You see, wholeness. So my translation of this verse 7, the Torah, the teaching of the Lord, is all-encompassing. In other words, it applies to everything. It's not perfect. Because when we hear the word perfect, it's just a different sense. You see, the God's teaching is all-encompassing. Now, that actually is a clue to how talk about God's instruction might have to do with creation, right? Because creation looks big and is big to us. So the kind of the way I fit the two pieces of Psalm 19 together, the creation part and the Torah part, I think what the psalmist had in mind is to affirm something like their perception of God's teaching or will is to be observed, as it were, as a kind of structure of the universe. You see, it applies to everything. So the teaching of the Lord is all-encompassing. NRSV says reviving the soul. Again, there's that word soul that I don't like, as in lift up your soul. So my translation here is the Torah, the teaching of the Lord, is all-encompassing, making life possible. In other words, God is the source of life. You see, now you can argue with that from a secular point of view, but from their point of view, they're celebrating the gift of life as God's gift. And in fact, it's God's teaching or will that makes life possible. So the teaching of the Lord is all-encompassing, making life possible. And then they've all kinds of synonyms for words related to Torah, the decrees, the precepts, the commandments, the fear of the Lord, the honoring of God, ordinances of the Lord, verse 9. The ordinances of the Lord are true and righteous altogether. That ordinances is an interesting word because it actually, if you look at the Hebrew, it means a word that's related to justice. So it's something like God's will for justice or God's justice rules or something are true. And righteous altogether. So actually you have a pairing of what the psalmists frequently pair and the prophets frequently pair, the Hebrew roots for justice and righteousness. And that's a clue, it seems to me, as to what Torah is all about. And also maybe a clue to how action is of the essence. Torah, the reason I reject the translation law is because what does that suggest? That God's will is about obeying rules. Yeah. So the law, we think the Ten Commandments and all those stipulations. So it's not just the Ten Commandments when you read Exodus through Deuteronomy. It's how many? The Torah is about obeying rules, all of them, all 613. Of course, there are no Christians who try to obey all those 613. Orthodox Jews, maybe, and not even all Jews, but Orthodox Jews. But here, the translation law leads one in that direction about trust or faith is about obeying rules. God's rules, yes, but still, it's about obeying rules. Now, which I think is why it's so important to suggest that Torah is not just obeying rules. Torah is about implementing the will of God. So the will of God is what? If we look to the other Psalms, this is part of the case I'm making in my project here. The clearest intent in terms of the will of God are Psalms like Psalm 96 and 98, where it says, I think we may have looked at these some, but those are enthronement Psalms that portray God's coming into the world. If you look at the end of Psalm 96 and 98, they're almost exactly identical, not quite. But they both, you look at Psalm 96, beginning with verse 10, for instance. Say among the nations, the Lord is king. There's the enthronement dimension. God is the ultimate sovereign. The world is firmly established. That's what Torah is about. God's teaching is to, and the reason it's all encompassing, it's to set the world right. That's what God's about, and that's what Torah is about, it seems to me. The world is firmly established. It shall never be moved. God will establish justice, or judge, but better establish justice among the peoples with equity. And after that has been affirmed, that is that God and God's will are the stabilizing force in the universe, if you will, it's not surprising that in response to that good news, the celebration is not just a human celebration, it's a sort of world-encompassing celebration. Let the heavens be glad and the earth rejoice and the sea roar and all that fills it and the field exult and everything in it. Then shall the trees of the forest even sing for joy before the Lord, for he is coming. Very misleading in English. It sounds like a future event. In Hebrew, it's either a participle or a perfect tense, which means the Lord has come, or the Lord is coming right now. Not to be waited for passively, as if God will come fix it. God is here now. And the key for me, and this has everything to do with Torah, is what is God here to do? And the psalm says it, although the translation is not good in the NRSV. For God has come not to judge the earth, but to establish justice on earth. You see, that a judge has the connotation of punishment, negativity, criticism, and so on. God is coming to set things right, not to get even. God doesn't need to get even. And it's not out to get even. Before the Lord, for God has come. God has come to establish justice on earth. God will establish justice in the world with righteousness. There's the pairing of justice and righteousness that you have in Psalm 19 even. God will establish justice in the world with righteousness and among the peoples with his, NRSV says, truth. I would translate that faithfulness. You see? So what is attending to Torah and affirming Torah all about? It's about the establishment of God's justice and righteousness. It's about changing the world from the way we find it to the way God wants it to be. There's one more piece of this, that's Psalm 82, that defines divinity by criticizing the Canaanite gods and goddesses and defining their mission, or God's mission, as justice and righteousness. And what, according to Psalm 82, will justice and righteousness consist of? Psalm 82, verses 3 and 4. Give justice to the weak and the orphan. Maintain the right, there you go, justice and righteousness, of the lowly and the destitute. Rescue the weak and the needy. Deliver them from the hand of the wicked. That's what God wants done. That's what God teaches to do. And it seems to me that's our calling, the calling of the Hasidim, or the faithful ones. If our identity as steadfastly loved or steadfastly loving ones, faithful ones, our identity is all bound up with who God is, steadfastly loving, and what God wants done. That is justice and righteousness defined as seeing the poor, the weak, and the needy, first of all, evaluating what we can do about it, and then taking action, you see. So that sort of convergence of psalmic material around Torah, around God's fundamental character, hesed, or steadfast love, and around God's fundamental will, justice and righteousness. To me, that adds up to that's what I'm arguing, at least. That adds up, if you see the whole thing, to what I'm calling an activist spirituality. So that perhaps culminating Lenten virtue might be the one we've added today. To act, that is, to wait in the sense of active waiting, not passive waiting. There's where probably the word hope, to me, is a better word. That hope energizes us, to how I'm putting it several times in the volume. Hope invites us and energizes us and equips us to join God at God's work in the world. And that work is fundamentally setting things right for those who need help the most, essentially. I see that it's 9:45. We're supposed to stop at 9:45, so I will stop now. Any final words, or we didn't get to 107. Read it. That's your homework. And notice that the refrain, it's got two refrains, actually. One where they're in trouble and cry out for help. And the other where they affirm God's steadfast love. So steadfast love is, again, a key word there, not surprisingly. Any final words or questions before we adjourn? Well, thank you again. It's always good to be with you. Alan has communicated with me in the past, so thank you, Alan. I'm sure he's in conversation with others of you, so thank you for the opportunity to return. And I'll look forward to being with you again someday. Yeah, thank you.
Thank you. I think your three Sundays with us has taught us a lot, including be careful how you read the scriptures. What you read isn't always what you get.
My students in Old Testament Survey are noticing that you can read all kinds of things in the Bible, so it's you need to be careful, you see, about what we bring away from it and discern a kind of what I call an overall trajectory. So yeah, right.